This week we study Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 1 recounts how Israel came to be in Egypt, explains to us that Israel became slaves to Pharaoh, and tells of how Pharaoh decided to eliminate them by having every baby boy thrown into the Nile. This week, Moses, who will deliver God's people from their slavery, will be born. The passage is Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, and if you have not yet read it, I recommend that you pause and read it now. In verses 1 and 2, we read that a Levite man married a Levite woman, and that they had a son. For those who are perhaps just starting out here in Exodus, Levi was one of Israel's 12 sons, so both the man and his wife were descended from Levi, cousins or distant cousins of some degree. It is the natural thing and a good thing that they should have a son, but it is a difficult thing given the circumstances. Pharaoh has insisted that all the boys be thrown into the Nile, and anyone who finds him will be breaking Pharaoh's decree if he leaves the boy alive. For this reason, the Levite woman hides her son for 3 months. As anyone who has had children knows, however, keeping them quiet is extremely difficult. Sometimes when they are small, their cries are not more loud than a cat's meow, but it doesn't take long before you can hear them a mile away. At 3 months, his mother needed a new plan. And so she made the baby a basket in which to hide him. Now, you should note that the King James translates the word basket more accurately than most other translations do. The Hebrew, in which the passage is originally written, calls the basket an ark, using the word teba. This is the same word used of Noah's big boat, which carried him through the flood. So we get the idea that this is more than just a basket. It is a boat basket, and it isn't just any boat basket. It is a boat basket designed to carry a person through a time of great trial and destruction. The basket, incidentally, is coated with the same asphalt-like tar substance, bitumen, which we saw used as mortar at the Tower of Babel. We've also seen bitumen before in Genesis chapter 14, where some kings fell into a pit of it during a battle. Now, the mother places her baby in the basket in the Nile and places his sister nearby to keep watch over him. The mother's motivations at this point are not entirely clear. It is perhaps her intent that she should simply leave the boy to fate. She was ordered to throw him into the Nile, so lacking a better option, she has done what she was told in such a way that the boy was kept safe. She may have simply hoped, in so doing, that God's hand would be at work and the boy would somehow make it out of the situation safely. And, in fact, that did happen when Pharaoh's own daughter discovered the boy. She may, however, have not intended to let the boy go. Perhaps she was simply hiding the boy in an obscure place where she thought no one would hear his cries, and left his sister to watch him during the day with a plan that she could sneak back to nurse him as needed. We wouldn't expect any person of prominence to suddenly find him here, but I suppose stranger things have happened. Or maybe she put the boy in a place where she knew the princess would be, hoping that her son would be found by her, and that the princess would show some compassion. Then again, perhaps the mother intentionally put the boy where he would be found as a protest. She was told to put the baby in the Nile, and she said, "Fine, here he is, in the Nile. Like you asked, are you happy now?" Whatever the case, Moses' mother showed a certain ingenuity in hiding him. We have no record of any other women doing similar things. I would guess that many others tried to hide their babies and did so with varying degrees of success. There were probably also others who simply gave in. They knew they couldn't hide a crying baby for long, so they just laid back in helplessness and allowed the injustice to run its course. Better to do that than to be ruined for fighting, they reasoned, and we must presume that there would be punishments for those women who did fight back. But Moses' mother did a few things that I think are an excellent example for us. In the first place, she was concerned with doing that which was right. and was willing to do whatever she had to do in this regard. She knew that it was wrong to kill her child. She valued his life, and whatever the consequences, she was going to do everything in her power to save him. In the second case, Moses' mother did the best she could do with what she had at her disposal. Building a basket boat was creative and labor-intensive, but she did it, and she did it cheaply, with raw materials that were available in her environment. Anyone else could have come up with the same plan and executed it, but Moses' mother is the one who went the extra mile of thinking out a plan and putting it into action. She wasn't passive about doing right. She looked at her circumstances and found a way to make do with what she had. And third, while the passage doesn't say it explicitly, it must be the case that she leaned on God for a resolution to the problem. If this woman didn't believe in God and trust in him for help, I find it unlikely that she would have taken these measures or that God would have chosen her son and made her actions work out as well as they did. But God did choose her son, and he worked in Moses' mother such that her plan was effective. So the princess showed up for a bath, found a crying boy in a basket, and pitied him. The princess recognized immediately, likely because he was circumcised, that this was a Hebrew boy, the son of an Israelite. My guess is that the princess wasn't a fan of her father's edict to kill all the Hebrew boys, and particularly after having her heartstrings tugged by this child in distress. At this pivotal moment when she finds the boy, his sister walks in to give the princess some direction on how to handle the matter. Better to use her power of suggestion than to sit and see how things play out, no doubt. So the sister suggests in verse 7 that the princess needs a Hebrew woman to nurse the child. And not only that, but the girl will find just the right person for him. Now, it is my guess that the princess was not so thick that she couldn't see what was going on here. There's a Hebrew baby in the wilderness and a Hebrew girl who wants to find him a Hebrew nurse. You don't exactly have to be a rocket scientist to guess that the girl probably knows who his mother is and is going to fetch her. The princess goes along with the plan in what looks to me like an intentional defiance of her father's attempt at genocide. She not only sends the boy back to his mother to be nursed, she also pays the family a wage to do so. But having a partiality to the boy she found, she claims him as her own son, and when he is old enough to leave his mother, he leaves his home in the Hebrew slaves and is raised in the household of Pharaoh's daughter. She gives the boy the name Moses. The word Moses, of course, is the English way of pronouncing the Greek way of pronouncing the actual Hebrew word. The original name is Moshe, and she chooses it because out of the water she drew him up. The Hebrew word for drawing something up is Masha, so you can see the similarity between Moshe and Masha. We might as well just say that she named him Drew because she drew him up. It is interesting that she named him in the Hebrew way and with Hebrew word. Perhaps she was even more partial to the Hebrews than we initially guessed. Now, the peculiar circumstances of Moses' birth will ultimately lead him to have an even more peculiar life. Moses, more than anyone else, is poised to set the people of Israel free and to lead them. He has many strengths, having been born a Hebrew in this way. For one, he is one of the children of the promise, a person with a special connection with God. But he is also acceptable to the Hebrew slaves. We will see many times in Moses' life that the Israelites rebel against him, but my guess is that if he had not been one of their own, they would never have followed him at all. Moses also, as a Hebrew, has an affinity for the Hebrews. He wants them freed from slavery because he is ultimately one of them, even if he does have access to the Hebrew upper crust. Moses must also have been notable among the Hebrews because he is a rare surviving male. We don't know exactly how long Pharaoh's plan of eugenics went on, but it didn't go on for so long as an entire generation. We have no indication as to why it stopped, but Moses' brother Aaron also survived, and we have no real indication that babies were being killed long after the incident with Moses and his little ark. So while there were Hebrew men walking around in Moses' adulthood, the point is that we should suppose that men of his age were not very common, because many of them were probably thrown into Nile. Moses, as a survivor at that age, must have stood out in a crowd. Imbued with all the strengths of a notable Hebrew, Moses will also attain all the strengths of a high-class Egyptian. Moses will be an educated man. He will be able to read and write, something which we would suppose most Hebrew slaves could not do, but which is absolutely essential for the work which Moses must do. Being raised in Pharaoh's own palace, it seems likely that he will be trained in leadership and will understand how to corral masses of people, skills which he will undoubtedly need. He will also be exposed to, if not intentionally trained in, the law of the Egyptians, and this is experience that will surely color his work as Israel's lawgiver and judge. Not only this, but Moses will be well connected. When the time comes for the people of Israel to leave Egypt, Moses will have a personal relationship with Pharaoh. Now, the scriptures aren't entirely clear on exactly how close that relationship will be. We have it in some popular film depictions that Moses and Pharaoh were like brothers. This makes for good drama and storytelling, and it may be the reality, but such is not stated specifically in the Bible. It seems somewhat unlikely that Pharaoh's daughter had a son who would one day ascend to the throne. Such hereditary positions usually pass through male heirs. Even if this throne passed through a female heir, we have no indication that Moses' adoptive mother would be that female heir, and also have no indication that she had another son. I would guess that her willingness to take Moses in was perhaps an indication that she did not have another son, but that's just speculation. Regardless, the point is that Moses will be, at the very least, known to Pharaoh, and will have some sort of familial relationship to him. At most, they will have a relationship which is quite close. This relationship will provide Moses with the access that is an essential component of the story of the Exodus. All of that makes for a pretty good skill set. Of course, to lead Israel in the wilderness after they leave Egypt, Moses will also need to have the skills of navigating the wilderness. If you read on in the chapter, you will discover that Moses soon gets exactly that when he flees Egypt and lives for many years as a shepherd in Midian. So Moses is perfectly poised to lead God's people. He has the Hebrew background, the Egyptian education and connections, and the wilderness leadership skills of a Midianite. If you were trying to hire a leader of Israel to lead them out of slavery, this is the guy you would want to hire. He has the perfect resume. But look at how he got here. It is clear that God did an amazing work to put Moses in exactly the position he ended up in. Would you ever have guessed that the princess would take a bath and find a baby in a basket while she did so? Who ever heard of such a thing? Even if you had a good reason to put a baby in a basket in the river, you could probably do it a million times and never once get a result that good. Of course, we should remember why Moses went into the basket in the first place. Pharaoh's brutal policy of eugenics created the circumstances that led a Hebrew to arrive at his doorstep and eventually set the Israelites free. Ironically, the policy which Pharaoh enacted to strengthen his kingdom and weaken the Israelites served to strengthen the Israelites and weaken his kingdom. It seems that the tighter Pharaoh squeezes, the more his power will slip through his fingers. I believe it is pertinent to note this, though. Had Pharaoh not begun to kill the Hebrew boys, Moses would not have gone into the basket, and the Israelites would have been without their leader. It is another example to us of a familiar biblical theme. Man sets out to do something evil, but God uses it for good, and in his supreme wisdom, God has a plan to use suffering in the short term to bring about a greater good in the long term. I can imagine that during this time, there were thousands of Hebrew women who cried out in utter despair when their sons were brutally murdered. I am sure they asked why, not realizing that this had happened so that their people would ultimately be freed. But it was not only for the freedom of their people. It was for the freedom and safety of people right up to the present day. Pharaoh's tyranny serves as an example to us of what happens when power becomes centralized behind a man who is not bound by good laws. It is a warning which is still heard around the globe, and the law of Moses has served as a foundation, an inspiration, and an influence for legal codes all over the world. Had it not been for this event, your Bible would be radically different. Your culture would be radically different. Your morals would be radically different, and you would live in a world which would be unrecognizable to you. So it was a horrible tragedy what took place in Egypt. But God had not forgotten his people. God was working out his plan. I can only suppose that it is the same in our lives. God is at work running his plan in the world for the greater good. Perhaps we will suffer in this life and not know why, never seeing that the suffering that happened to us was essential to ensure that others would be properly placed into key positions. Or perhaps we have been placed into one of those positions ourselves, and unbeknownst to us, God is giving us a skill set that we will need to do an incredible work on his behalf. We should all bear well in mind, whatever our circumstances, that God is in control and that our lives, big as they may seem to us, are really only one tiny piece in a complex puzzle with many billions of other pieces. So wherever you are today, I hope that you will not despair, but that you will do as Moses' mother did. I hope that you will choose to do the right thing, even if it is difficult, and that you will do the best that you can in the circumstances that you have, trusting that God will work out the rest for the final best interest.
For those of you who might be listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.